Welcome back to Leading Through Life. I'm your host, Bruce Clifford, and today on the podcast, we have Robert Long, co-chair of the Appellate and Supreme Court Litigation Group at Covington and Burling Law Firm in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for taking the time to get together today, Mr. Long.
It's great to be with you, Brooks. Thank you for having me.
For our listeners at home, here's a little background on Mr. Long. He graduated from the University of North Carolina, where he was a Moorhead Scholar and Yale Law School. He is married and has two children. His impressive law career includes assistant to the Solicitor General of the United States and a law clerk to Justice Lewis Powell of the U.S. Supreme Court. He has argued 18 cases before the Supreme Court and is described by Chambers USA as a brilliant lawyer and a great oral advocate who gets tremendous respect from the court. He is also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a lecturer at the University of Virginia School of Law. Is there anything you'd like to add, Mr. Long?
Oh, thank you. That's a very nice introduction, Brooks. I appreciate that.
No problem. Today, we are here to talk about leadership. Mr. Long, throughout your career, you've had many important leadership roles, particularly related to bringing cases before the Supreme Court. How would you describe your leadership style?
Well, you know, I could tell you what kind of leadership style I aim to have, and then I'll be honest and say that I don't always achieve what I aim for. What I aim to have is a flexible leadership style because, you know, what kind of leadership is really effective is going to depend on the situation, the people involved, and the task that you're trying to accomplish. So sometimes the most important thing is the task, you know, what needs to get done. And maybe the people you're working with are not that experienced with doing that kind of task. So you need to be pretty focused on, okay, here's what we're going to do step by step, and here's how to do it. But in other circumstances, and this is actually a lot of what I do in my legal work, you have really accomplished, experienced, able people that are on your team. So you don't need to tell them the basics. They know the basics. And so a lot of times good leadership is just getting out of their way and letting them do their thing and not sort of creating unnecessary obstacles for them. Sometimes good leadership is having a good relationship with the people on your team. And if they're having some sort of, personal issue or, you know, something is just troubling them to, you know, recognize that and see if there's something you can do about that. Sometimes that's the most important thing. So that's my goal, is to be flexible and to be exactly what is needed in the situation. But I think most of us, and certainly including me, you have kind of a natural leadership style. And it does sort of fit the kind of work I do. I think my natural style is I try to lead by example and hope sort of people pick up the good parts of what I'm doing and improve on the bad parts. And so it's less sort of classic leadership in the sense of, you know, okay, follow me, people, you know, we're going to go over here and capture this hill or something, yeah. And more of a quiet style. But that's the reality. But the goal is, and I think probably what we should all strive for, is to think about the situation and try to provide the leadership that is called for in that situation.
Definitely. Where do you think your leadership has the greatest impact in your professional career? And out of the Supreme Court cases that you've argued, is there any particular case that you think had the most impact?
Well, that is probably of my work that I've done in law. The cases that I've worked on in the Supreme Court and argued in the Supreme Court have probably been the ones that have had the biggest impact, just because the Supreme Court is the highest court and sets the law for all the other courts and for all of us, really. But I need to be very humble about this. You know, the judges and the justices of the Supreme Court are the ones who make the decisions. I don't have anything to do with that. I just submit arguments to them, written arguments and oral arguments, and hope to persuade them. And sometimes they adopt those arguments and sometimes they don't. And, you know, beyond that, by the time the case gets to the Supreme Court, lots of smart people, smart lawyers and other smart people, have thought about the case and developed arguments on one side and another side. Sometimes there's more than two sides to a case. Sometimes there's three sides or even more. So a lot of what I do is sort of presenting the best of those arguments that other people have come up with. So, you know, my impact, to the extent I've had any, has maybe been to nudge the law a little bit, you know, in a direction that maybe it wouldn't have been quite that exact direction if I hadn't been there. But, you know, I'd be fooling myself, and, you know, if I said it's made gigantic difference. You know, that there's probably been a case here and there that if it hadn't been well argued, it could have come out the other way. So it could actually have been a different outcome. But that's the biggest impact. But it's like most of us in life, it's a limited impact. It's not completely changing the world, but I hope it's made the world a little better.
Wow. When working on a case, how do you go about getting the best work from your team?
Well, so I am very fortunate in that, you know, the kinds of people who would be working on a team on a Supreme Court case typically are these really great people, great lawyers, really smart. They're usually very highly motivated to work on Supreme Court cases because that's the big deal in the world of law. So they're, you know, in many ways just ideal people to have on a team because they're very, very good and very, very highly motivated. You know, some do have more experience than others. So sometimes I am working with younger lawyers who are not, this might be the first time they're doing a Supreme Court case or a Supreme Court brief. And so that's going to be a little different. But those folks, you need to, you know, really give them a lot more background information, a lot, you know, sort of tell them more about what we're trying to do here, give them examples of things so that they can work from, make sure there's plenty of time to work through issues as they come up. But if I'm working with somebody who's done this, you know, 10 times before, then it's more, you know, we just talk about the issues and what's the best way to argue this. Is this a good argument or not? Is this the argument to lead off with, or should it be, you know, somewhere further down the list? So those are some of the basic techniques. But honestly, I have not had to have a lot. I haven't had to develop a lot of, you know, great techniques for dealing with recalcitrant or, you know, incompetent members of the team, because I've been very lucky. I haven't had to deal with that.
Probably makes sense if you're arguing cases from the Supreme Court. What do you do when your associates have a different approach to a case than you do?
So that actually does happen, and I always look on it as kind of an opportunity, because the whole essence of this kind of work that I do is you're trying to persuade people of something. I mean, judges, so it's a specialized audience. It's people who've been to law school, and now they, you know, after a certain amount of time doing something in law, they become judges, and often they have a lot of experience judging cases, but you're trying to persuade them. So it's basically the same as trying to persuade anybody of anything. So if your teammates, you know, the people you're working with, don't think you've got the most persuasive arguments and think their arguments are more persuasive, that's a good time to sit down and really listen to what they have to say. So we will at least talk it out. Often we'll put it in writing and say, okay, you know, let's see how that looks if you write it. Because in appellate law in the United States, the written arguments are actually more important than the oral arguments that you stand up in court and give. So it's very important to see, you know, how does this argument look in writing? So we really talk it through. And, you know, there have been times when I've been convinced that my initial take on the case was not the best one. I mean, a lot of times it's not like this is right, this is wrong. It's more, okay, well, that's a pretty good argument, but this is a better argument, you know, or so it's sort of shades of strength in the arguments. But, you know, sometimes I'm not convinced, and then we'll say, okay, here's the decision. We're going to argue the case this way, or we're going to make this the lead argument.
Is there ever a time where you need to, like, collaborate or compromise your ideas kind of together and one to make a better case?
Yes, many times. And I tend to be, I'd say lawyers who do this kind of work fall into two groups. Some can sort of see, well, I can see merits on both sides here. Let's sort of meet in the middle somewhere and do a compromise approach. And that's my nature. So I often come out there. The other type of lawyer sort of says, you know, look, no, this is how I see it. And this is how I want to argue it. And that's the way I'm going to argue it. And I think, again, it's hard to say that one approach is right and one is wrong. My compromising approach can be counterproductive if it makes the arguments too blurry and too unclear. So that's something I really have to watch out for. The kind of my way or the highway approach that, you know, okay, here's my argument and that's the argument I'm making and I'm not making any other argument. That can, you know, can work really well if the judges buy that argument, but if they don't, you're sunk, you know, because you didn't make the other argument that might have persuaded somebody. So I am by nature more of a compromiser, so I've done that many times, but doing it in a way that is helpful is, you know, that takes skill. And if you do it badly, it can be a disaster.
Yes, definitely it does. You've been described as a great oral advocate. How did you learn to become so good at speaking and presenting a case?
Well, I did not do speech or debate in high school or college or any of the kinds of things that would be sort of, you know, the most obvious kinds of preparation. So I just sort of learned on the job and, you know, I learned by doing moot courts, which is something we do. You know, you have actually a whole prep session where people play the role of the judges and they try to ask the questions they think the judges will ask and you try to answer them. And then you get critiqued and they say, you know, well, that answer wasn't very good or that answer was good. So that's very important. So for me, a lot of it is just preparation, not just the moot courts, but being really, really familiar with the case. So both the record, you know, the facts of the case and the legal issues and all the relevant legal precedents, the statutes, the cases, you know, everything that bears on it so that you can talk about it. And even most of oral argument in the United States today in federal courts is questions and answers. So it's not standing up and giving a speech. If you're lucky, they'll let you talk for a minute or so, and then they'll start interrupting you with questions. And so a big part of it is I try to think of all the questions that the judges might ask. And then I try to think of a really good but concise answer, because another thing about oral argument today is you don't get unlimited time. I mean, the Supreme Court, it's 30 minutes per side. Federal courts of appeals, it's, you know, 15 minutes. 20 minutes would be really long. Sometimes it's 10 minutes. I mean, it's really short, and so these cases can be pretty complex. So you have to really think about your answers. And for me, having thought about it in advance and having thought about the words I'll use is really helpful. But I will say, you know, I don't think I'm a golden-tongued orator. I went to school in England where they really put a premium on that kind of ability to speak extemporaneously in complete sentences, complete paragraphs. And I was never taught that. I can't do that. It's not really what is done in the Supreme Court and our courts of appeals. So it doesn't hurt that I can't do it. And as I mentioned earlier, in fact, the briefs, the written arguments are far more important in our U.S. judicial system than the oral arguments. So I've actually spent more time trying to be a good writer than to try to be a good talker.
Wow. How important is this skill for people who want to lead?
Well, I would say for all kinds of leadership, communication is essential. So in order to be a good leader, you absolutely must be an effective communicator. And, you know, what type of communication is going to be needed is going to vary with the type of leadership role. I mean, this specific type of, you know, very structured talking that I do in these oral arguments and questions and answers from these highly prepared, highly trained judges, that's probably pretty specific to what I do. But in general, you know, being able to communicate and inspire is critical to leadership, I would say.
You're also a teacher. How do you use your leadership skills with students in the classroom?
So I haven't taught for several years now. I say that I'm on extended leave. I'm not sure my leave is ever going to end, but I love teaching and I did it for 20 years. And you know, the classroom, you'd be very familiar with this. It's like, you know, the setup is extremely hierarchical and, yes, you know, the teacher is standing up there lecturing at the class and, you know, gives out grades and all kinds of things. So it's, you know, you don't have to be much of a leader to get through a class in law school or college or high school just because the situation sort of puts you on such a pedestal. But what I always tried to do, and I would call this leadership, but you could probably have a debate about whether this counts as leadership or something else. But I would try to sort of figure out what was each student's growth edge or what they needed to work on. And I would try to encourage them to work on that. So for example, if you're going to be a lawyer, it is really important to be able to talk and in a public setting. And, you know, a lot of law students have no trouble with that. That probably won't surprise you to hear. But actually, a lot of law students are, I mean, some of them are just shy in general. Some of them, they're not really shy, but they're just not used to talking in public. You know, we're in a large class, and I taught some big classes and some smaller classes. So especially in a large class, I would really try to encourage the people who were reluctant to talk, and I tried all different ways to do it. Sometimes I'd have like panels and say, you know, every 2 weeks or something, you're going to be on the panel, and that means I might call on you that day. Sometimes I just encourage them. Sometimes people, they have no trouble talking, but they're, you know, don't always think about what they're going to say before they say it. And that's also for a lawyer, for any of us, really. But for lawyers, you want to be thoughtful about what you say. So that's very much what goes on in law school. You know, somebody says something, and so you say, well, let's see, that if that's true, then this absurd consequence follows. So do you really think that? Or can we modify that? You know, can we salvage part of it? So that was kind of the main thing that I encouraged people to do and to say, because I was an adjunct professor. I was not a regular faculty member. I was just somebody who would come in and teach a course or two a year. And so I just, you know, encouraged them to say, you can do this. It's not easy. You know, it's hard, but you don't have to be a superman or a superwoman, and you can work with the talents you have and you can build on them, and you'll just be amazed at what you can accomplish. And that just giving people a little bit of confidence and also sort of, you know, getting to know them enough to know what was maybe the thing they needed to work on the most that semester, that seemed to really help a lot of students.
I also understand that one thing that is very important to you is giving back. How do you use your leadership skills in this area?
Well, I would say mostly doing what we call pro bono cases. So that's where you do cases and you're not paid for doing them, but you do them because you think they're in the public interest. Pro bono publico is, you know, for the good of the public. And, you know, I would say when you're giving back, you have to think about what do you have to bring to the table? And, you know, what I have spent a lot of my life doing is these appellate cases. So that's kind of what the number one skill I have to bring to the table. So some of the Supreme Court cases I've done have been pro bono cases. Some of the cases I've argued in the Supreme Court have been pro bono. And they're actually some of the ones, looking back on it, that, you know, give me the warmest, best feelings, you know, because I just think that was really good use of my time.
What are some of the challenges of leadership?
Well, there are, you know, lots of challenges of leadership. And again, I think it's going to depend a lot on the circumstances you find yourself in. I guess, you know, at a high level of generality, the challenges are, one, you have to sort of know what is an appropriate goal and an appropriate pathway to get to the goal. So that's, you know, sort of where are we trying to lead to? And then the second part is, that, you know, how do you organize, inspire people to work in that direction, you know, towards the goal you've identified? And they're both important. I mean, if you have this interest in leadership, you may be most interested in the second part of how, once you've come up with a good goal and a good, you know, pathway to get to that goal, how do you inspire people? I will say, I actually took a course in leadership in college. I was in a program that was supposed to help develop future leaders, and we had a whole course. And one of the exercises we did was a big long list of things that you might take if you were in a survival situation, you know, out in the woods, and you had to survive for, I forget what it was, a week or something. And you could pick like 10 items from a list of 30 or something like that. Which 10 would be the best? Mm-hmm. And they had experts in survival and outdoor skills, you know, agree on. So this, unlike a lot of real world situations, there was considered to be an objective, correct answer. And they didn't tell us that until the end. But with the exercise was, everybody went off, took 10 or 15 minutes to figure out what they thought were the 10 best items and reasons why. And then we had a debate. And part of it, this was a, I don't know if this was a good exercise or not, was you got credit if your items, you turned in your list and then you tried to persuade everybody to adopt your list. And so the way it worked out for me was, my list was the best in the whole group. We had I forget how many were in the group, you know, 8 people or 10 people or something. Ones were the ones that the experts are closest, you know, nobody was perfect, but I came the closest to having the ones that would actually save people's lives. But I was really mediocre on like persuading people to adopt it. So, maybe that means, unless I've learned something since then, that, you know, I'm a bad person to be advising on this. I think part of the issue in that exercise was everybody was trying to argue for their own items because they were going to get credit if they could persuade other people. And so they weren't really listening to, wow, that might be a better idea. And that I think that happens a lot in the real world. People already have their ideas about what should be done, And so trying to get people to that place where they can be open-minded enough to listen to a better idea is really important. Sometimes we were talking about compromise a few minutes ago. Sometimes, you know, you might have to say, okay, here's a compromise that I think will work. I don't think it's the best outcome. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, maybe 90% or 85%. But I can see I'm dealing with somebody who's not going to agree with me on the 100% solution. And if we don't reach agreement, it's going to be 50% or 20% or 0%. Yeah. So sometimes I would say compromise is an important part of leadership.
Definitely. Throughout all your leadership positions you've been in, who are some of the teachers or mentors that have had the biggest impact on you?
I've been really fortunate to have a lot of great mentors, you know, in college, in law school, the two judges I clerked for, Judge Wisdom and Justice Powell, were great mentors. I had some great mentors at Covington and Burling, my law firm, and in the Solicitor General's office. I just mentioned one man named Ed Zimmerman, who was a partner at Covington and Burling, my law firm, and he was a great mentor to me. He was an antitrust lawyer, so he was not primarily an appellate lawyer, but I started out doing antitrust law, and he was just a great teacher. He had been a full-time law professor at Stanford Law School.
Wow.
He was, you know, he had done that for at least 10 years, I think. So he was a very experienced teacher, and he liked to teach. So he, to me, he was just perfect. You know, and I would watch him, watch how he would do something, how he would interact with a client or, you know, a government official or something. And you just would learn so much from watching him. And then he would also take time to explain things to me or tell me, you know, little hints. I mean, the very first hint he told me, I'll just relate this quickly. We were on the phone with a client. I had just started working at this law firm where I've been ever since. And I didn't know much about anything because I was a beginner. But a question came up about getting an extension of time to file a brief at the Supreme Court. And I, you know, sort of perked up and, oh, that's one of the few things I know anything about. And so I piped up and told the client, oh, that's very easy. That's not a problem. We can definitely get a 30-day extension. And so the client said, well, great, thanks. And, you know, the call went on. And after the call ended, Ed Zimmerman, this mentor, said, well, he said, you know, I hope you're right about that. He said, now, you know, you want to be very careful about telling clients that something is easy, because if you're wrong and it's not easy, they're going to think either you're not a very knowledgeable lawyer and you think something's easy when it's not, or you're not a very competent lawyer and you can't even do something that's easy. And he said, you know, if you tell them it's easy, that's fine, but they're going to take you at your word and they're not going to give you much credit for it because you just told them it was easy. Anybody could do it. So, you know, that's very practical advice. And he didn't. He said, look, if it's easy and you're 100% sure it's easy, sure, tell the client. But don't, you know, don't say that if you only think it's probably easy or something, because you're that's just, you know, leads to trouble.
What advice would you have for young people who want to become leaders? And maybe is there any advice that you'd like to tell your younger self if you had the chance?
Well, I would say if you want to become a leader, you know, keep your eyes open for people that you think are good leaders of all ages, you know, your age or older, and sort of watch them and try to figure out what makes them a good leader. And are there elements of that that I could do myself? I mean, everybody's a little different. And sometimes you'll just say, look, no, that person has some talents that are not my strong suits, or has a style that just doesn't fit me. But so that would be one piece of advice. Just, you know, watch out for good leaders. And when you find them, sort of try to study them. And then second basic piece of advice is, you know, when you get an opportunity to practice and develop your leadership skills, take it. And, you know, you'll make some mistakes. Everybody makes some mistakes, but be sure to learn from your mistakes.
Definitely. And finally, is there anything else that I didn't ask that you'd like to share? Any, maybe a final statement or anything of that sort?
No, just I think this is a great thing you're doing, and I'm very honored to have been included.
Thank you. That is all the questions we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Long. It was a pleasure to have you. For our listeners at home, keep your eyes open for our next episode with Reed Bowles, a successful entrepreneur, investor, and turnaround professional in a variety of industries ranging from manufacturing to software to branded consumer products. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.